This webinar is being recorded.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kathy Kanoff, and I am with Risk Management Solutions. Today, I'm going to take some time to speak with you today regarding infection prevention and control program. I will stop at intervals to look for questions, but I would prefer to do them all at the end, but I will stop every once in a while just to check the chat box, so feel free to type in your questions at that time. So let's go ahead and get started. We all know in nursing homes, skilled nursing facilities, and assisted living facilities provide medical and personal care to people who are unable to manage independently in the community. Over 4 million Americans are admitted to or reside in a nursing home and skilled nursing facility each year, and almost 1 million are residing in assisted living facilities. Per CDC, the data regarding infections in long-term care facilities is often limited, but it has been estimated in the medical literature that 1 to 3 million serious infections occur every year in these types of facilities. Of course, the most common are the urinary tract infection, diarrheal diseases, antibiotic-resistant staph infections, and many others. Infections are a major cause of hospitalization, and as many as 380,000 people die each year of infections in a long-term care facility. So, what is an infection? Well, an infection, the definition is it's the invasion and multiplication of microorganisms such as bacteria, viruses, and parasites that are not normally present within the body. Some examples of these kind of microorganisms, or some of the most common types, are, you know, you have bacteria, which can be the Streptococcus, Staphylococcus, E. coli, Enterococcus. You have viruses, the rhinovirus, we all know about the coronavirus, herpes virus, the norovirus, and there are some parasites that make it into our realm as well, such as the scabies mite, maybe the roundworm or the tapeworm. It's important to understand, in order for infection prevention and control, I think it's really important to understand, you know, what the chain of infection and what that is. And there's six different links within that chain of infection. The first one being that pathogen itself, you know, what is the infectious agent? Is it a bacteria? Is it a virus? Is it a parasite? And then the next chain would be the reservoir or the source, which means it's the habitat. It's where that agent normally will live, grow, and multiply. Reservoirs or the sources could either be human, it can be animals, or it can be the environment itself. And then you'll have the portal of exit. This is that pathway by which the pathogen leaves its host. The portal of exit usually corresponds to the site where the pathogen is localized. For example, you have the influenza virus. They exit through the respiratory tract. So then you'll have the fourth chain, which is the route of transmission, the means of transmission. And that's how the transfer of the infectious agent gets from the reservoir to the host. And, you know, that can be through direct contact or droplet spread. It can also be through an indirect contact, such as the air, the food, water, blood, inanimate objects such as your handkerchiefs, your bedding, your surgical scalpels, and it can also be through vectors such as mosquitoes, fleas, and ticks. So that's how, you know, how they're getting from the exit to the entry. So your portal of entry is actually the manner in which that pathogen is entering that susceptible host. The portal of entry must provide access to certain tissue in which the pathogen can multiply or the toxin can act on, can act. So the infectious agent uses the same port to enter the new host that they use to exit the host, the source host. So for example, your influenza virus, you know, it's exiting the respiratory tract of the source, and it's typically entering the respiratory tract of the new host. And then you, of course, you have that susceptible host. You have that new host. And that's the final link of the chain of infection. The susceptibility of that host is dependent on genetic factors, comorbidities, their immunity, their ability to resist infection. Each one of those links are very important, and the chain has to be connected in order for it to be viable. So any interruption or broken part of the chain means that we are preventing an infection or controlling the infection. So we'll be talking about that as well throughout this presentation today. We've kind of already alluded to that there's some common infections among nursing home residents. The respiratory infections, you know, those are the bronchitis, the pneumonias, the influenzas, and we're all dealing with that COVID-19 right now. You can have urinary tract infections are very common. Soft tissue infections such as cellulitis or impetigo or abscesses. Along with some skin infections, and that could be that necrotizing fasciitis, or maybe some infected pressure ulcers, diabetic wounds, vascular ulcers, herpes zoster, or scabies, and herpes simplex. And we can also have gastrointestinal infections, you know, and those could be bacterial and viral, gastroenteritis, and some C. diff. So it's very important to understand, and we're going to talk about infection control. So, you know, what is infection control? Well, infection control refers to the policies and procedures that we are using to minimize the risk of spreading infections. And that's especially important in hospitals, in human healthcare facilities, and even in veterinary facilities. The whole purpose of infection control is to reduce the occurrence of the infectious disease. And we kind of learned already that these diseases can be spread by human-to-human contact, animal-to-human contact, and anytime a human comes in contact with an infected surface, that is tiny droplets of that infectious agent that are suspended in the air, food, or water. And of course, I think we're all familiar with at this point in time some of the regulating entities that we have controlling and who are guiding our infection prevention and control practices, you know, starting with the Centers for Disease Control. They play an integral part in determining protocols. We have the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which actually are issuing us our federal regulations in which we must comply with. You also are now working with state regulatory agencies, your county health departments, and your occupational safety and health administration, otherwise known as OSHA. So let's talk about some of those federal regulations. What are, you know, what is expected of us long-term care provider? We're looking at infection control, F880, in which the facility, we have to establish and maintain an infection prevention and control program, which is designed to provide a safe, sanitary, and comfortable environment. And it's to help prevent the development and transmission of communicable disease and infections. And there might actually be, and I should stop right here, there might actually be some assisted living facilities out there that not necessarily these are the requirements of participation for skilled nursing facilities. But I think at this point in time, we have learned that we all should be pretty much focusing on the same practices and having some of these protocols in place, even if it's not a regulation for your particular entity, it's best practice. We also, at which, you know, your infection Prevention and Control Program. We'll include an antibiotic stewardship program. It's going to include your infection preventionist, and it's also going to include F883, your immunizations, in which as a facility, we have to have policies and procedures in place that ensure that our residents are receiving educations and are being offered those influenza and pneumococcal immunizations. And I'm sure in the near future, it's also going to include something for the COVID-19. So as for the next slides, I'm going to take a moment here just to see if there are any questions. It does not look like I have at this point. So we're going to move forward, and we are actually going to start talking about some infection prevention and control strategies. You know, we talk about having a written infection prevention and control program that has specific policies and procedures. Those policies and procedures need to be based on the current nationally recognized evidence-based guidelines, regulations, and standards. So, you know, going back to those entities that are regulating us, we need to make sure that we are staying current with the ever-changing rules that we are seeing right now. And so as we see changes in guidelines, as we see changes in regulations and standards, we need to be going back to our policies and procedures to make sure that we are in alignment with those guidelines, regulations, and standards. When we're looking at you have a written protocol, you develop these, but you want to make sure that they're implemented. I mean, it's no good having this great book, this great program written, but no one's following it. So, and that's kind of what we're going to talk about as well. So some of the components that we want to make sure that are included in these policies and procedures are, first and foremost, a system of surveillance. How are we going to track and identify possible communicable diseases or infections? Before they spread to others, what's our tracking? How are we going to, look at this and identify this? What system are we going to have in place? We want to have policies and procedures as to when and to whom possible incidents of communicable disease or infection should be reported. What is it that we have and who do we report it to? You're going to want to have policies and procedures about your standard and your transmission-based precautions, and when they are to be followed. You want to have isolations, when and how to isolate if we need to for a particular resident. You want to have policies and procedures in place that cover the circumstances under which the facility would prohibit employees with a communicable disease or infected skin lesion from direct contact with residents or their food. You want to definitely have hand hygiene protocols, procedures that are followed by the entire staff. And you also want to include in your policies and procedures an annual infection control risk assessment. And you want to use a control risk assessment that is recognized by a professional organization such as APIC. You want to make sure that you're using you just take a good look at your infection control program on an annual basis and making sure that we have truly acknowledged all the possibilities of infection, the type of residents that we're caring for, and making sure that we have policies in place to make sure that our residents are cared for in quality of care and quality of life. We'll talk a little bit about the infection preventionist. I forgot to introduce myself really, but I've been in this business for 32 years as a nurse. And when the infection preventionist and some of these regulations came back in 2016, I kind of wondered, what is this role and how prevalent are we going to use them? Well, I think I've answered my own question at this point. The infection preventionist is a critical component of our infection prevention control program. We are, as a facility, as a skilled nursing facility, you are required to have someone that is designated and who has received specialized training in infection prevention and control. And they have to be at least on a part-time basis. I feel at this point they're working full-time and even overtime in their role. Your infection preventionist does play a significant role within your antibiotic stewardship program, and they are an active member of your quality assessment and insurance committee. They're responsible for the documentation of incidents of communicable disease and infections, identification of patterns and trends and plans of actions. So let's talk about that quality assessment and insurance committee plan. You know, the plan is that we should at least have quarterly committee team meetings. And during any QAA committee team meeting, you should be discussing infection control practices. You want to, during that time, as far as, focusing in on infection prevention and control, you're going to be discussing, what's currently going on in your program, what's currently going on in your building as far as the types of infections, the spread of infections, are there patterns, are there trends, looking at any kind of change in policy review, if there's a new standard that's come about or a new rule that's come about, are we in line with that? Is our direct care staff, is all of our employees aware of the changes in our policy and procedures? Maybe even are our employees following our infection prevention and control program? And if they're not, why are they not following it? And what do we need to do about it? So, it's an ongoing discussion, and it's looking at what you have going on in your building compared to, and then kind of looking at it and saying, hey, why are these things going on? Getting a root cause and then putting some plan of actions into place to promote sustainable practice improvements throughout the facility. So definitely QAA is an important component. So breaking down into this QAA process, I want to start talking about some infection prevention and control strategies. With that infection surveillance, I mean, what are we going to look at? What do we want them to be looking at in that surveillance? You want to be tracking and trending and monitoring any resident infection, any employee infection. You want to have a system in place for that early detection in management of potentially infectious systematic residents, because you want to make sure that you're implementing precautions as appropriate and timely. You want to make sure that your surveillance practices include the use of published surveillance criteria, whether that's from the CDC, McGears, to define infections so that we all know what we're talking about when we're speaking of infection. You want to have your program written down, have a data collection tool that is comprehensive, that, that's getting all of the data that you're needing and compiling this and, looking at this data on a daily basis and forming analysis and looking at the data and making sure that, we're providing any follow-up activity to any of our outbreaks. And again, we want to make sure that we are reporting of communicable diseases are being promptly reported to local, state, public health authorities, making sure that everyone knows, if you're seeing signs and symptoms of this, you need to contact that, such and such person who's going to contact such and such person. Everything needs to be written and available to your staff. So, you know, the antibiotic stewardship program, this is also a very important part of the infection prevention and control program. You know, we really want to have a program that is established, that includes the, you know, established protocols for antibiotic use and the system to monitor that usage. You know, we have to start from, you know, what I call the governing body, has to take the initiative to improve antibiotic use, and they need to take a strong leadership role, in ensuring that this program is followed. It's not just by the facility staff. An antibiotic stewardship program includes your medical directors. It includes your healthcare practitioners. It includes your pharmacists. It means it's all hands on deck to say that, hey, we are only going to, you know, we're going to have written policies on antibiotic prescribing that we want to make sure that the intent is that we're using antibiotics when it's appropriate based on clinical indications and laboratory findings and national standards, you know, that we want to incorporate the use of an infection assessment tool in which our nursing staff, our direct care staff can utilize in order to make sure that the signs and, you know, that we're getting a comprehensive assessment so that we can making sure that antibiotics are only being used as appropriate. You know, some of those tools are, you know, the ESPAR tool for UTI. You know, apply the McGeer's criteria, minimum criteria. And of course, education. Education is important, not only for your direct care staff, not only for your healthcare practitioners, your pharmacists, you know, your nursing staff, your medical director, but it's also important that we have to talk and discuss with the residents and their families and making sure that we're following just some general principles for antibiotic use. And those would include, you know, when possible, we want to obtain the microbiology culture prior to starting antibiotics. You know, we're only using an antibiotic based on an evaluation that most likely caused the resident's symptom is a bacterial infection. Use of antibiotics only for as long as needed to treat the infection. And because this will minimize the risk of relapse or control active risk to others. You know, remembering that antibiotics are generally not indicated for colonization, to treat colonization. And of course, antibiotics are ineffective against viral illnesses such as the cold, influenza, and viral gastroenteritis. So, you know, it's a very important that antibiotics are used with much discretion. And I think it's important that as, you know, that we need to make sure that we're doing comprehensive assessments in order to convey to the physicians so that they can appropriately treat. And of course, your infection preventionist will be involved in helping manage antibiotic use along with the pharmacist and medical director and your nursing director. So looking at some infection prevention control strategies through the environment, you know, look at our linen management. You know, we want to make sure that on an ongoing basis, you know, again, you can have these policies and procedures, but are they being implemented? Are they being followed? So we really need to take an active role in ensuring compliance. And looking at linen management for one is, you know, how is your personnel handling your soiled linens? You know, are they handling them with minimum agitation to avoid the contamination of the entire environment? You know, are we bagging them? Or, you know, somehow containing them at the point of collection. You know, is the receiving area for contaminated or soiled linen, is that clearly separated from your clean laundry areas? You know, and then when we do have our clean linen, you know, how is it packaged, transported, and stored to ensure cleanliness and protection from contamination? I know I've been in facilities and, you know, you see your linen carts in the hallway, And you also see, you know, personal care items being stored there, pops being stored there, drinks being, you know, those kind of things being stored there. Again, you know, anytime that we're putting a soiled object, something that has touched our hands onto a clean linen cart, it has the potential of spreading an infectious agent. You know, let's look at the water management system. You know, your water management program needs to be based on national guidelines and toolkits. You know, the Center for CDC, you know, the EPA. You know, this includes control measures such as your physical controls, your temperature management, your disinfectant level control, visual inspections for the biofilm, slime, scale, and sediment. You know, a risk assessment should be conducted to identify where Legionella and other opportunistic waterborne pathogens could grow and spread in the facility water system. You know, so what kind of testing protocols and acceptable ranges for control measures do you have in place? And are you documenting the results of those testing? That's all, again, an integral part of our strategy plan. So let's talk about healthcare personal safety. When we're looking at it, we want to know that, you know, again, that program is including policies and procedures that includes the TB testing or TB screening protocols for healthcare, you know, the offering of the hepatitis vaccination, you know, the annual influenza, you know, encouraging them for vaccinations. You know, again, that, you know, illness reporting, you know, making sure that you're not, you know, if you're not reporting to work or you're not having people that are working that are ill themselves, because the chance of transmitting that that infection agent increases. So you definitely want to make sure that you, you know, that your employees are coming to work healthy. And if they are sick, that we need to take that seriously and have them not work in direct contact with residents or their food. So let's talk about education. You know, education should be a formal training, and, you know, you should have an education at least upon hire annually and, of course, as needed. Your essential topics should include, but not limited to, you know, what are my, as a facility, what is my facility specific infection prevention control policies and procedures? They are not universal, which means one facility might have, you know, they might be very general from one facility to another, but there might be some specifics. So you want them to know what it is that you're expecting. You know, you want to include the routes of disease transmission, you know, what types of bloodborne pathogens, multi-drug resistant organisms, hand hygiene is always important, your sanitation procedures, and your transmission-based precaution techniques. Those are all your education. What goes hand in hand with education is your competencies. Again, competencies should be conducted upon hire. You know, prior to anyone working independently, one should be observed to see that infection prevention and control practices are being followed annually and as needed. These competency validations would include, but not limited to, hand hygiene, making sure that hand hygiene is being done correctly and at the appropriate intervals. What about the application and removal of personal protective equipment? You know, they should be, you know, staff should be observed for proper application and removal of, you know, personal protective equipment such as your gowns, gloves, and face masks. It's not, you know, it's not just important that you wear the PPE, it's how they are applied and how they are removed as well. You know, looking at your medication injection and intravenous practices and sharp safety, you know, making sure that injections are prepared using clean techniques. You know, needles and syringes are used for one resident only, that the rubber septum or the vial is, you know, when it's, you know, is if it's opened, that it's cleansed properly. What about the care of use of point of care devices? You know, are we cleaning items such as your blood glucose monitor or your INR monitor or your pulse oximetry monitor. You know, how are those point of care devices being cleaned? And so again, you want to watch the staff that are responsible in using those devices. You want to make sure that they're following the proper protocol. And if they're not, we need to, you know, re-educate them in their needs. You know, urinary catheters, you know, looking, making sure that they, you know, we're using the proper protocol is being followed in order for infection prevention and control. Respiratory therapy, that includes the administration of your inhalers, your nebulizer treatments, your suctioning, wound management, you know, observation, you know, or the staff hand hygiene during wound management, you know, using the, you know, appropriate PPE, you know, cleansing of reusable dressing care equipment, such as your bandage scissors, you know, clean dressing supplies, how are they stored? And then cleaning and disinfection of environmental services and reusable equipment. You know, that's, you know, observation of your staff cleaning the resident rooms, the bathrooms, your high touch surfaces in common areas, such as your handrails, your tables, doorknobs, you know, wheelchairs, shower chairs, therapy equipment, blood pressure cuffs, IV poles, you know, enteral feedings and IV machines, the list goes on and on. And, you know, and I say that, you know, again, you know, you can be educated, you can voice understanding, but going out and doing it and being competent in it is two different things. So I think it's important as managers, and not only as managers, but for each other. If we observe something being, you know, infection prevention, practices not being followed, you know, we need to intervene. We need to stand up and be vocal and say, you know, hey, you're not doing that the right way. This is, you know, let's pull the policy out. Let's do it. Let's revisit it. Maybe they are doing it per policy and our policy is outdated. So it's really important that not only are we educated, but that we are competent and we maintain those competencies. So that's an ongoing screening progress. That's an ongoing observation. Looking at the resident health, and, you know, let's talk specifically about resident health and, you know, what kind of immunizations, you know, that we're having in place, you know, what policies and procedures, you know, for the tuberculosis testing, pneumococcal vaccinations, your annual influenza, you know, these are all policies that we want to encourage because we understand that vaccinations and immunizations can decrease the likelihood of infection. We want to, you know, our routine monitoring of our residents and looking at them ongoingly for that early identification and treatment of the infection. You know, it's to avoid hospitalization, improve resident outcome. The earlier we can identify it, the earlier that we can treat and manage that from spreading. You know, some facilities use the stop and watch program. That program basically guides everyone that if there's, you know, stop and watch your residents. If you notice anything unusual, different, you know, they're talking less, you know, they're increased pain, they're eating less, they're drinking less, they're just not themselves. It's important that concern is voiced to the licensed nurse. And then it's up to the licensed nurse to act on that, report, assess, and communicate. Let's talk about that resident assessment. So if we have a resident that we feel is kind of not their usual self, you know, we need to be looking and assessing the resident for related signs and symptoms of an infection that, let me go back there. I apologize. We're going to look at vital signs. First and foremost, vital signs are usually an indicator. You know, you're going to have that elevated temp or maybe elevated respirations or lowered respirations. So look at vital signs. You know, look at your urinary tract infections. If you're, you know, what's the color, the clarity, the odor? You know, are they having pain, burning, or frequency? Respiratory infections, listen to their breath sounds, their cough, do they have a cough? Is there a presence or absence of any secretions? You know, what's their oxygen saturation level? Any shortness of breath? Any evidence of pain when they're taking a breath? Your wound infections, you know, looking at the peri-wound skin, noting what their that color, the presence or absence of drainage. If you do have drainage, what's the description of that drainage? You know, does it have any odor? Does the wound have any pain for the resident? You know, and cellulitis, looking at, you know, skin color and temperature of skin and pain. The more comprehensive the resident assessment can be, the better picture we can paint for the healthcare practitioner in order to make sure that we're treating the right illness, to make sure that we're treating with the appropriate medications and sorts. And of course, care planning is also an integral part. You'll have acute care plans, and you know, these are short-term plans of care. You know, you have to develop them at the onset of the infection. You know, your interventions, whatever you decide you're doing, it has to be communicated to the direct care staff. You want to, you'll discontinue the acute care plan when that resident no longer has an active infection. And of course, you're updating it with any changes in treatment and or condition. You'll have a comprehensive plan of care in place when you have a resident who has maybe a chronic infection, or a resident who is at high risk for recurring infections. You know, you want to make sure, again, that you have a resident-specific care plan in place for the infection that they're at high risk for means of preventing them from getting that infection. And again, you can have a well-written care plan with very much appropriate interventions, but if they're not being implemented and followed and delivered 24 hours, 7 days a week, they're not necessarily going to be an effective part of infection prevention and control. You also want to be able to focus on some documentation requirements. You have to be able to say that you've done your due diligence. So part of that is you want to observe and document every shift until the infection resolves. You want to make sure that you have documented your physician notification that will be initially with any signs and symptoms of infection, and update it as needed if the condition does not show improvement. And you want to make sure that the resident and resident representative notification is documented, and we're discussing with them notification of the infection when it was discovered, you know, what we're doing with any, continue with any updates or changes in course of treatment. Here's a documentation example, and it says, you know, when we're looking at this example, you know, which one is the better infection assessment for the resident? In this example, resident remains on antibiotic, no adverse effects noted. What this is basically saying is that we are looking at the antibiotic and the antibiotic itself, but we don't know about how the resident is resolving with that infection. The better way is that a resident continues on Keflex for pneumonia, breath sounds clear, upper lobes diminished in bilateral lower lobes. There's no cough noted. The resident becomes short of breath with minimal exertion. You know, their oxygen saturation at rest is at 96% on 2 liters of nasal cannula. And then there's their vital signs and denies pain. This documentation actually shows the resident's response to the antibiotic, not just monitoring for the adverse effects of the antibiotic. And each assessment should always include the assessment of the resident's condition, what that antibiotic is being treated for. It's very important because it goes along with your antibiotic stewardship program. It goes along with actually treating appropriately for infections. So let's take an opportunity now to look at, you know, if we have to isolation of the infection, the use of personal protective equipment is going to be based on the mode of transmission. That is going to, whether we use gowns, masks, goggles, we're going to have postage of signage on the door to alert staff and visitors of these precautions. Remember, your mode of transmission, you can have that contact, which is that infectious agents, which are spread by direct or direct contact with the resident or the resident's environment. You can have droplet, which are pathogens that are spread through the close respiratory or mucous membrane contact with respiratory secretions, or the airborne, which is that infectious agent or an organisms that remain infectious over long distances when suspended in air. You might have to consider possible room change considerations. Do you have negative pressure rooms? Are we going to cohabitate roommates with the same infections? Or are we going to be able to offer a private room if able? And remember, the goal is to isolate the organism and not the resident. Isolating a resident to their room can lead to depression and associated complications. I know for right now, what we're all going through and the restrictions with this, it's very challenging to make sure that our residents do not feel isolated and have some of those adverse events based on being isolated as they are. So let's just talk and take a few minutes now about the outbreak management. And that's what we're dealing with right now. This is in any case, whether it's the COVID-19 or the influenza. We have to look at if the volume or severity of an infectious disease significantly is threatening or impacts our day-to-day operations, we have to activate that our facility's emergency operations plan for infectious disease. You have to be notifying that local and state health department. And you're going to obtain the guidance from that those local and state health department and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We're following these right now. I think, we have those clearly posting signs for the cough etiquette, the hand washing and other hygiene and high visibility areas, providing hand sanitizers and face or nose mask if practical, advising that ill visitor to delay visits to reduce exposure to risk to the residents, advising your staff to check for signs and symptoms of illness and to not work if sick, activate emergency staffing strategies as needed. You're going to limit exposure between infected and non-infected persons, considering the isolation of the cohorting of ill residents. You're going to conduct recommended or even increase cleaning and decontamination in response to the actual infectious disease. In addition to the everyday infection prevention and control practices, consider, and this is what we've had to face in this particular outbreak, is that have we closed ourselves to new admissions? Is that a possibility until we can gain control over our outbreak? Limited visitation right now. We know that visitation is being directed by the government. So, you know, visitation is very limited as to who can come into your facility. But those coming into your facility, of course, need to be screened. You know, rescheduling of non-urgent appointments, you know, limiting the transport of residents to the emergency room for life-threatening needs only. And then, of course, anybody who is coming into your facility that you're screening, the staff, the entity, volunteer, or visitors for signs of illness. And again, making sure that all of the infection prevention and control practices that we have put into place, that we want to document that we are following the procedures that we have. Your documentation is going to be evidence of your due diligence. It might not necessarily save you from a citation per se, but it might save you from the severity of a citation. A final thought. Success of a facility's infection prevention and control program is contingent on all facility staff being responsible for ensuring infection prevention and control practices are followed accurately and consistently. I thank you for your time. I'm going to open it up to see if there's any chat messages. If I'll give you an opportunity. I don't see anything in the group chat. If anybody wants to open that up now, you certainly can do that. Give you a moment. I don't see any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Kathy, for your help today. We appreciate you speaking, and we will have a recording of the webinar available by Friday. We will be sending a link out to the recording that you can use and make available to other staff that could not participate today. Thanks again, Kathy, and everybody have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.